Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you guys doing? In the sessions that we have just completed, we did a mini series about some of the modern trends in Islam. We started actually with some kalam type topics. We spoke about Al-Ghazali, Ibn Taymiyyah, and these kinds of things. And then we moved to some of the modern trends. Now, we're going to be talking about some of the shubuhat. Now, this is the final thing we're going to be doing right before we start the intellectual seerah on the on January, inshallah. So this is going to be about six lessons altogether, and we're going to cover some things which we've already covered before, but because of the importance of these topics and the repetitive nature of us either hearing these topics or dealing with them, we're going to be covering some of them again and some other shubuhat topics in some greater detail that we haven't before. The first thing we're going to be looking at today is jihad, which of course is something I think we've covered before, but this time we have to cover it with a bit more participation, because I've spoken a lot, you know, in the past. So the first question I want to ask is, what is jihad and what are the different types of jihad?
Is it to strive and struggle?
Great. So there's a linguistic definition, and then there is a, you call a terminological definition. Okay, and this subdivision of linguistic and terminological definition is something we need to get used to. They say lughatan wa istilahan, the terminology and linguistics. So what you've mentioned is correct. It is the linguistic definition. And this linguistic definition is in the Quran. For example, in the end of Surah Al-Ankabut, the end part of the 29th chapter, was it man jahada fina lanahdiyannahu الَّذِينَ جَاهَدُوا فِينَا لَنَهْدِيَنَّهُمْ سُبُلَنَا وَالَّذِينَ right? وَالَّذِينَ جَاهَدُوا فِينَا لَنَهْدِيَنَّهُمْ سُبُلَنَا right? And the ones who have strived in our way. So this takes more of the linguistic, you know, because جَاهَدُوا فِينَا. So they have strived in our way. This is the kind of translation you're going to find for this particular verse in the Quran. So certainly it's not a wrong thing to say, because many people think this is us being apologetic by saying that jihad means to strive and to struggle. It's not actually, it's the linguistic term. You know, it is what it means, and there is different types of jihad. And one of the jihads is, in fact, jihad on nafs. So what is jihad on nafs, Furqan?
Jihad, the one. So basically, I would describe me trying to improve, become a better Muslim, but I don't know, praying on time. So something that you fight with your own nafs to become.
Yeah, so the nafs, absolutely, this is a good answer. The nafs is the self or the soul or the self, whatever how you want to translate it. And a jihad on nafs is basically you kind of fighting against yourself, for lack of a better term, but doing so in the spirit of self, spiritual self-improvement. And what are the ways you can do jihad on nafs, Furqan?
So, becoming maybe more spiritual.
How so?
Praying, for instance.
Okay, brilliant. That's an excellent way of putting it. The Prophet ﷺ said, إِنَّمَا الْعِلْمُ بِالتَّعَلُّمُ وَالْحِلْمُ بِالتَّحَلُّمُ. And I think there's a hadith that says وَالصَّبْرُ بِالتَّصَبُّرُ, which basically, and I was looking into this hadith, very beautiful and interesting hadith, إِنَّمَا الْعِلْمُ بِالتَّعَلُّمُ, that learning, you know, it comes from you exerting yourself to extract knowledge, yeah, or acquiring knowledge is from doing, from the process of actually extracting the knowledge. الْحِلْم is forbearance. This is how they translate حِلْم, right? But it includes having self-control in situations where it's difficult to do so. It also includes being kind and so on for your, you know, people that you might not find it easy to do so. So this is hilm bittahallum. So you need to be a practitioner of hilm. In other words, the best way to improve yourself is by doing the activity. Sabr bittasabbur, that to be patient, you have to put yourself in a situation where you are afflicted by something and then you overcome it. But, you know, and this is a beautiful thing. I'll tell you something I was looking at, actually. In psychology, and many of you have heard the PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And actually, I was reading a book some time ago by some guy called Van der Kolk. And the book was called The Body Keeps Score. And he was an individual who actually pioneered the diagnosis of PTSD. And it was people that came after war, I think it was the Vietnam War, the Second World War, where they came to a center and he was explaining in the book like how, you know, he put together these kinds of general diagnoses, which then he could identify people who had PTSD. And PTSD is where a trauma in your life has caused you to kind of revisit that trauma. And he gives very interesting examples. He was saying like when he gives participants the chance to recall an event, if it's an event which is traumatic, they are more likely to remember and recall all the particulars of that event. Whereas if it's an event which is not so, then the memory of it is less vivid. And so these are some of the things of PTSD, obviously nightmares, scares, panic attack, all that stuff. It's become a formal diagnosis. But there's another thing which is very interesting, which is less spoken about, which is called PTG, which is referred to as post-traumatic growth, which in many ways, to crudely put it, is the opposite of PTSD. It's where calamity of in life or in such as, you know, has put you in a position which is improved. You look in the world in a different way now because of the calamity. And I was speaking with my uncle when I went to Egypt, in Alexandria. I think I told some of you guys this, and he had this very, my maternal uncle, he had a very traumatic experience where he was living in an apartment flat, and his wife was there, the kids were there, the kids, and then the building fell and they all died. His wife and kids died. And then he had another child, obviously my cousins, a long time ago though. They had another child living in another country and she died from natural causes. And then some time after that, his mom died. You know, so I was speaking to him and the way he speaks, it is absolutely renewed. He goes, I don't look at the world in a different way. I completely look at the world in a different way now. Because these cars moving here completely. I said, how so? He said, every second, I consider it to be extra time, bonus time. Like, it's different when you live through a situation like that. But when you come out with this thamara, with this fruit of post-traumatic growth, these are the kinds of things which has a spiritual and psychological lasting impact. There's a beautiful verse in the Quran, in Surah Al-Hajj, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, and you guys can correct me, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَعْبُدُ اللَّهَ عَلَى حَرْفٍ إِنْ أَصَابَتْهُ خَيْرٌ إِنْ أَصَابَهُ خَيْرٌ اطْمَأَنَّ بِهِ وَإِنْ أَصَابَتْهُ فِتْنَةٌ انْقَلَبَ عَلَى وَجْهِهِ خَسِرَ الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةِ. There are some people who worship Allah on the edge, literally on the edge. If something happens to him which is like good, he's happy with it. اطْمَأَنَّ بِهِ وَإِنْ أَصَابَتْهُ فِتْنَةٌ انْقَلَبَ عَلَى وَجْهِهِ. And if fitna or a trauma afflicts him, he falls on his face. خَسِرَ الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةِ. He loses the world and the era hereafter. So I'm not saying you can't have post-traumatic stress disorder as a Muslim. I'm saying if it reaches the level of yes, and if it, which is hopelessness, this is kufr akbar. Actually, because وَمَن يَأْسُ مِن رَوْحِ اللَّهِ إِلَى الْقَوْمِ الْكَافِرُونَ. The Quran says that who will be the one who has hopelessness of the mercy of God except for the disbelievers. Interestingly, it's not something that is mentioned in the Waqid al-Islam ibn Abdul Wahhab. That, you know, the term is, I don't know why he put it there, he should have put it there. It's, you know, it's, if you lose hope of the mercy of Allah, then you can become a disbeliever, actually. It's what Yaqub was saying, and he was the figurehead of patience to his son Yusuf alayhi salam. So, or generally about the situation that he was in. The point is I'm making is, the jihad al-nafs should not be underestimated. I think we know that. I think Ibn Qayyim, I was reading it, he was talking about jihad al-nafs quite at length, actually. It's not something which we're retreating. When we talk about jihad al-nafs or self-jihad, whatever, it's not something which is fake or something which is PC or politically correct or something. It's something we should actually focus on, the spiritual side of our religion. So, because when we talk about jihad, and if we speak about fighting for this whole session, it may give the wrong impression, which is that the only fighting that is to be done is against people, not against ourselves. And there is jihad against the self, and there's a jihad against the devil, shaitan. There's jihad against all of these forces, which we believe metaphysical forces, spiritual forces as well. Now that we've put that on the table, what other types of jihad is there? What other taqseemat did the fuqaha put forward, Ma'ath? What other categorizations are there?
Well, there's obvious on the physical one.
Within the physical one, what are the categories?
Defensive and proactive.
Beautiful. Okay, so can you give us some understanding of that?
Well, defensive would be defending yourself and your community from outsiders or antagonists. And then proactive would be proactively attacking somebody for a legitimate Sharia reason.
And give us some examples in history where both of those things happened.
Right, the Battle of Badr.
In Islamic history, for example.
Sorry?
In Islamic history.
Yeah. The Battle of Badr would be a case for a defensive one. It was the Battle of Mu'tah, right? Which was the offensive. It was more of a raid, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can make the argument that because, you know, if you look at the reasons why the Mu'tah happened, like the emissary was sent and then he was killed and these kind of things, it was responsive. But certainly, like, Fatah Mecca was expansive and all those, you know, these things that came after, like Hunayn was proactive, right? So, you know, إِذْ أَعْجَبَتْكُمْ كَثْرَتُكُمْ, you know, when you were a lot of people, وَضَاقَتْ عَلَيْكُمْ الْأَرْضُ بِمَا رَحُبَتْ, you know, and the earth swallowed you because of what is. So this was a time where the Muslims were a lot, you know, and this expanding now, and it happened at the time of the Prophet. The majority of the Prophet's conflicts, though, were defensive or proactive in his time. The majority were defensive. That's not to say there was no proactive ones. We're just saying the vast majority were defensive. Yeah. Now, let's move on to the next slide. Now, if someone says, "Well, if your religion has to have an expansionist element," so then therefore there is no situation or conceivability of peace being made between Muslims and non-Muslims. How would you respond, Mehdi, to that?
Yeah, so like people who are Jews or Christians, maybe even of other religions, that could live within the Islamic State.
So okay, so that's within the Islamic State. You're right. So now you've got the Islamic State inside of it, and then you've got Ahl al-Dhimma, the Mu'ahad, the Mustamin, all these people, like where they have a contract. Is it mean forced conversion, or do we believe in forced conversion, or?
No. What's the ayah in Surah Baqarah?
La ikraha fi al-deen.
Yeah, la ikraha fi al-deen. So there's no compulsion in religion. So it's not possible to compel other people or force them to join Islam.
Okay, now, so what about if we're living in the modern age, if we look at the books of fiqh now, they still speak about jihad or talab. Some of them say it has to be done every year. Like, jihad talab has to be done every year. So in the modern world, how do we navigate this reality? If it has to be done every year, then and someone brings it to you, says, look, it says in your book of fiqh here, that has to be done, jihad talab has to be done every year, or every other year, or every whatever. Yeah. So how would you respond to that in the light of the Quran, Sunnah, and the fiqh that you've gone through before?
So there's like certain stipulations to do jihad talab. So you have to meet like certain criteria to be able to do that. And the current Muslim situation doesn't allow that.
Excellent. So that's one way of looking at it. But even if we had the fully fledged Islamic governance, which was fully legitimate, is it within its power, Shakir, to on other grounds? And what kinds of grounds would they be? To create some kind of treaty?
Yeah, so if you have treaties in place or agreements with other states or other polities, then it wouldn't be allowed for you to be treacherous. Awfu bil uqood in Surah Al-Ma'idah, that you have to maintain your treaties, your covenants with other peoples. And it would actually be, I mean, you could actually argue that in many situations it could be in the interest of the Muslims to have those treaties or covenants in place. It's something that the Prophet ﷺ did at certain times for strategic reasons. So it's very feasible.
Beautiful. And so awfu bil uqood means what? How do you translate that?
To be faithful to your contracts or your agreements.
Is that a general rule? For Muslims and non-Muslims, or is it just for Muslims?
Yeah, for Muslims and non-Muslims.
Okay, so now I've got a question, and this may be a bit of a... for you, Shakir. In the Quran, what is the only exception? Maybe I'm saying the only, but one of the only, I should say. Mm. Or give me an example of a Quranic exception of where you shouldn't fulfill your contract. This might be a difficult question.
Where you shouldn't fulfill your contract?
Yeah.
Since Surah Tawbah.
I'm not going to give you any... Okay, everyone can get involved, but I'm not going to give you any.
Well, are we considering situations where the other side has already broken the contract first?
Okay, what's the ayah?
The first ayah of Surah Tawbah. Bara'atu min Allahi wa Rasulihi.
Okay, that could be... But there's something more clear I'm thinking about.
If they start it,
there's something more clear than this about breaking the contract, about where you shouldn't fulfill the contract. What I'm thinking about is وَإِن نَكَثُوا أَيْمَانِهِمْ أَيْمَانَهُمْ مِنْ بَعْدِ أَهْدِهِمْ وَطَعْنُوا فِي دِينِكُمْ فَقَاتُوا لَأَمْنِتِ الْكُفْرِ. This is a situation where you shouldn't fulfill the contract, because it says if they break their contract, إِن نَكَثُوا أَيْمَانَهُمْ مِنْ بَعْدِ أَهْدِهِمْ, after they have made a contract with you, وَطَعْنُوا فِي دِينِكُمْ, and they have attacked your religion now, فَقَاتِلُوا أَيْمَةِ الْكُفْرِ, then fight the leaders of this belief. So contracts are two-way situations. You know, it's not just one way, it's two ways. I mean, if they break it, there's no contract anymore. You can't make a contract, so they break it, and then they say, well, why are you doing X, which we've agreed to? Because you've already broken the contract. There is no contract no more.
Is that the same with the situation in Medina, when the people left the battlefield, and they had a contract to, when they actually left the battlefield, a quarter of the army left, and they broke the contract there and then.
Which one are we talking about?
I think it's the first.
Badr.
Yeah, where they literally left the battlefield because the Prophet didn't listen to their counsel. One of them,
Uhud.
Yes.
I wouldn't say that's a contract issue. I think that's more of a ta'a issue, like an obedience issue.
Okay.
Because, you know, wa'fu anhum wa'fir lahum wa shawirhum fil amr. Allah says, he gives the Prophet advice on how to deal with them. He says, pardon them, forgive them, and seek their counsel in the affair. You know, وَإِذَا عَزَمْتَ فَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ, and when you have made up your mind on the issue, then have reliance on God and so on. So this is how contracts work in Islam. And this is, I've mentioned this before, I feel this is a very good point of commonality between liberal theory and Islam. Because consent and contract work in both kind of worldviews. Consent and contracts are very important to both worldviews. So it makes it possible for there to be business and so on. There's three ayahs which I think everyone should know. And I've mentioned this, I think, to you guys before, but this is important for us to, because this comes up all the time. What ayahs would you bring to the table if I were to say, listen, Islam is a religion which cannot get along with other people of other faiths? What ayahs would you bring? Let's say, Tariq, what would you say?
I know that if we're living in a... We have to obey the rulers, even if they're non-Muslim. As I don't know if that's relevant at all. So we can. I'm sorry, I don't know.
No worries. Think about the ayahs in the Quran, which one can think about to exhibit coexistence, that we don't want to combat the, or that, like, any, say for example, a non-Muslim person, that we don't have to have an adversarial relationship with them. Shaka, go ahead.
وَالْمُحْصَنَاتُ مِنَ الْمُؤْمِنَاتِ, that you can, وَالْمُحْصَنَاتُ مِنَ الَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْكِتَابَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ, that you can marry the Jew and the Christian.
And what would you be trying to prove with that?
Well, you know, if it's a bit, I guess, impractical, if on one hand, I guess, if someone says you're supposed to kill non-Muslims outright, but then on the other hand, you're marrying them, it's like...
They'll say that's the exception to the rule. It's a amadis khas. I'm just so, like, you know.
So you have to kill all of them except the ones that you marry.
Yeah, and the ones you take as slaves as well. I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Yeah.
So how would you respond to this?
لا ينهاكم الله عن الذين.
Okay, now you go to the. These are the ones that everyone. These are the ones, right? So this is chapter 60, verse 8. All right, this is the one that you wrote. لا ينهاكم عن الذين. What? This is the one, bring it, because this is a good ayah, like for this kind of purpose. Chapter 60, verse 8. That Allah doesn't, how would you translate this?
Allah has not forbidden you in relation to those who don't those who don't fight you in your religion or kick you out of your homes from being kind and cordial and just with them.
Okay. Who does Allah forbid you then? إِنَّمَا يَنْهَاكُمُ اللَّهُ
عَنِ الَّذِينَ قَاتَلُوكُمْ فِي الدِّينِ. Those who do those things, so those who fight you in your religion, أَخْرَجُوكُمْ مِنْ دِيَارِكُمْ, they kick you out of your homes, وَظَهَرُوا عَلَىٰ إِخْرَاجِكُمْ, and they like come together aiding and assisting each other in expelling you from your homes.
That what you do, that what's it continue there, how's it go?
وَمَنْ يَتَوَلَّهُمْ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ
الظَّالِمُونَ. What do you call it? يَتَوَلَّهُمْ, right? That you cannot be allies with
yeah,
those.
Yeah, you can't be allies with those individuals, yeah.
And whoever does so is?
I think it's Lalimun, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, transgressors or, yeah. Or the evil, the oppressors or the unjust ones. So, Allah is telling us two things. Who we should have cordial relationships with and who we shouldn't. I was speaking to one guy before who told me about his situation with some takfiri groups, some like, you know, extremist groups or something like radical, and he was saying that he was saying to them, you know this hadith in Bukhari where the woman gets punished because she's torturing the cat, and he said to him, like, what do you think of this hadith? He said, yeah, that shows you this haram to torture a cat. He goes, what do you think of torturing the disbelievers? He said that, you know, it's different. So this guy, he was responding, apparently, like, this is a chain of, he was like, if Islam is a religion which doesn't even allow you to harm an animal, how could it be a religion which allows you to harm human beings and animals and children and these kinds of things? And this is goes back to the hadith, which many of you should know. The first hadith they teach you in this kind of hadith studies, and they say it's the hadith, what do you call it? Mawal Musafaha, I can't remember what it's like. Musalsal bil awwaliyah, not Musafaha, this is a different one. It's Irhamu man fil ardi, irhamku man fil sama. Have mercy to those who are on the earth, and the one who is in the heaven will have mercy on you. And men is al-fadl amum, it's one of the general terms. So the general rule is actually to have mercy to people. And so, for example, Allah says in the Quran, وَقُولُوا لِلنَّاسِ حُسْنًا, and say good things to people. You know? And so this idea that there's an initial adversariality, or there's an initial enmity, or there's an initial antagonism, or initial whatever, this is not really the spirit or the letter of Islamic law. Because there's Islamically, there's initial mercy. You know? There's initial safety and mercy, and then after that, whatever happens, happens through instrumentality or exception. But it's not the initial state of, that's not what we want in the situation, best case situation. So if jihad happens, it happens as a result of either defending the territory or freeing up new land. That's basically it. What other examples would you give, Furqan?
Chapter 489.
Okay, and do you know the contents of that?
Do you want me to read it?
Yeah, please.
وَدُّوا لَوْ تَكْفُرُونَ كَمَا كَفَرُوا فَتَكُونُوا. It's that one, yeah?
Yeah, but there's a bit in the middle of it.
Okay.
إلا الذين يصلون إلى الذين يصلون
so
إلى قوم وبينكم وبينهم ميثاق أو جاءوكم حتى يصلوا
490.
Is that right? Yeah.
So from what I'm going to explain. Yeah, so if they immigrate and they become
except for the ones who are إلى الذين يصلون إلى قوم وبينكم وبينهم ميثاق أو جاءوكم حصرت صدورهم.
Yeah, except for those that have a pact with you.
Keep going.
I think so. How in Spanish on intertranslated?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No hablo español. No problema. Post traumático. Maybe Muaz.
Yeah.
What is the ayah?
490. It talks about who we can fight, and then it talks about the exception, and yep. Mentions that the exceptions are those who are allies of a people. You are bound within a treaty of those wholeheartedly opposed to fighting, either you or their own people.
Okay. And what is this? Al-Ja'ukum. The ones who came to you up.
Sorry?
It continues. It's a continuation. Yeah.
If Allah had willed, He would have empowered them to fight you. So if they refrain from fighting you and offer you peace, then Allah does not permit you to harm them.
Yeah. So it's very clear, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this is not abrogates, from my understanding. You know. So these are good ayahs to just bring. Because this idea of an impossible coexistence is defied by these kinds of hadiths and ayahs. Okay. So we need to make sure that we bring that. I think another line of argumentation is to show how many people have been killed by each civilization. Now there is a book which I have here. I'm just going to stand up and get it actually. I mentioned this I think before, but I want you guys to... This is an interesting way of making the argument. And I know we've covered this before, but repetition sometimes is important. This is a book, War and Peace in Islam. Yeah? And... This guy, Nazir Sheikh, he has these findings, which he goes through like definitions, what he defines as world civilization. So he puts all these different civilizations, he does, you know, and this is what he's got here. This is the ranking that he's got. Number one, he's got the anti-theists, the Buddhists, the Christian, the Indic, and the Islamic, yeah? And what he's showing is that the minimum death toll, maximum death toll, and median death toll. For example, the anti-theists, they've got the highest. If they're considered a civilization, he puts it at 95 million minimum to 152 maximum, right? He's got his own methodology. You can read it in your own time, but I'm just giving you an example. Then you've got the Buddhist. Now, people don't associate war and death with Buddhism for some reason, even though we have what we have with the Burma, what's going on in Burma and the Rohingyas. In contemporary times. But for some reason, Buddhism is seen as the true religion of peace or something. Even though the death tolls and the wars indicate to us that that's not the case. And here, Christian civilization, or at least in practice, there has been war from them. Christian civilization is in third place, 119 million to 236 million. This is the range. Then you have the Indic, you know, and then you have the Islamic. So even if you look at it from a perspective of death toll and numbers, I mean, just take a look at the 20th century. It's by far, all you have to remember is the 20th century is by far the most many people that have been killed in any wars that have ever taken place. The 20th century, World War I, World War II. You have to remember that. These are not Islamic. If you just remember this fact, It's almost insulting that people who come from civilizations like these speak to us as if they have the keys and that they can give us a lesson about this kind of thing. Obviously, you saw me speak about this with Jordan Peterson. And as you can see, like, he had to admit, you know, his positioning and so on. Like, it's indisputable. You can't actually dispute these evidences and these points. So just remember that. How else would you argue your point? Let's see. Let's open up to the floor. Mehdi, how would you? So what else now? Let's imagine I'm going to play devil's advocate for a little bit. You know, an atheist saying, look, your religion is a religion of hate, and it does not encourage coexistence. It's a religion of bloodshed. And you guys need to modernize.
Actually, the perspective of getting the ayah from Quran.
Yeah. Now, how would you? Now I'm putting this to you. How would you respond to this? Now let him finish first. Let me. We'll come to you in a second. Yeah.
This is the ayah in the
Quran. Just make sure you got 490 memorized. Yeah.
من قتل نفسا بغير نفس أو فساد في الأرض كانما قتل الناس جميعا.
Beautiful. Okay. So this is chapter 5, verse 34.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you're saying like Islam,
how would you translate this first?
Whoever kills someone, without yani, the right, like without the authority to do so.
So they haven't killed that person. Killed somebody. Yeah.
Yeah. So like a non-combatant.
Yeah.
Of fasad in the earth. Well, if they're causing corruption in the land,
then it's as if they've killed.
It's as if they've killed the entirety of mankind. So, I think it's just like an evidence to show that Islam isn't what they're saying.
Okay, beautiful. Now what would you say, Furqan? Tell me. So I'm coming with the same interrogation. How would you respond to it?
I would say, so you said that we Muslims are here to kill everybody. That's what our religion teaches us.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say if that's the case, then we're doing a very poor job of being Muslims. And not only in recent years, but throughout history. Like we've been very soft with the rest of humanity.
Yeah, and so fine, but you don't deny the fact that your religion was there to initially instruct you to kill the people. Then.
Initially,
so there was that at least at one point.
And what happened after?
I don't know. You tell me. I mean, so you don't deny this, yeah?
Yeah, I deny it, but my point is
how do you deny it?
My point is
implausible deniability.
So you're basically saying that we used to be Muslims and then we stopped being Muslims. Is that what you're saying?
No, I've said nothing.
Or Islam changed or something like that.
I'm saying that you know your religion instructs people to kill innocent bystanders.
But so let me understand this. Yeah. So my religion instructed me to kill, and then it stopped instructing me to kill people. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm saying that's why my claim.
I don't believe that. I think it was my religion was quite consistent
mm-hmm.
in the
what's the evidence
teachings.
Of that?
Quran is
the evidence. Where in the Quran?
The whole Quran.
Okay, well, you have to be more specific, okay? So next time, be more specific. Okay. Now it's your turn, Mehdi. Ma'ad, sorry. I'll come to you in a second, Mehdi, don't worry. Ma'ad, now it's your turn. So I say, look, you have a hadith that says, لَقَدْ جِئْتُكُمْ بِالذَّبْحِ. I've come to you with slaughter. And you have another hadith that says that, you know, أُمِرْتُ أَنْ أُقَاتِلَ النَّاسِ. I've been commanded to kill the people. Until they say Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah. Doesn't this indicate that your religion is clearly intolerant and is trying to kill people that are non-combatants?
Yeah, I would say if you take individual pieces of evidence like this out of context, especially we could construct any narrative that we want to. So the wise thing to do, or the academic thing to do, would be to take the evidence as a whole. Which our scholars have done, and see what the religion says when you take a holistic.
So,
what
did your prophet mean by "I've been commanded to kill the people until I said Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah"? No, he's not going to help you.
I forgot the context of it.
So you forgot? Okay. That's my point exactly.
Hold on a second. But there's unanimous consensus that we're not allowed to kill innocent civilians, regardless of.
So your consensus overrides the hadith, the clear hadith.
No, that must be in a different context then.
So what is that context?
I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure the scholars who came to the consensus knew it.
So Mahdi, what do you think the consensus? What do you think the?
You have to take the hadith in context of the Quran. So, the ayah that I mentioned. So if you have the hadith and the ayah has a higher weight of epistemic weight than the hadith. So here the Prophet didn't mean just to kill. No, 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 just the hadith. We accept the hadith. Okay, we also accept the ayah. We accept both.
So how do you square the circle?
We're saying this one is specific, about the hadith of Rasulullah Sallam, and the other one is general. That's it.
Which one's general?
The ayah.
But he says, "Umirtu an uqatil an-nas." I've been commanded
to
kill
an-nas. That doesn't mean
alif lam.
Everyone. Doesn't mean.
Oh, I mean, it's from al-fadl al-umum. It's alif and lam. It's ta'rifiyya. It's. Let's pretend this believer is very clever.
Allahu a'lam. And we take it in context of the ayah, and the hadith will never contradict what the ayah.
Well, here you got a general hadith and a general ayah, and they seem to be contradicting.
It's not general hadith.
Well, I mean,
it's alif lam, but.
Alif lam. So what should we do with it, Shakir? How do we deal with this?
The hadith, umirtu an uqatil an-nas. An-nas, like, you're saying that it means every single human being?
I'm saying yes.
Is that including
let's
Muslims?
Let's assume, yeah. How?
Is that including Muslims?
I see, that's good now. There you have it. Right? That's, you know who argued on this basis? I heard it from Abu Ishaq al-Huwaini. He actually was doing sharh of this hadith, yeah? He's a scholar of hadith in Egypt. And he says, if we took the hadith to be am in a very clear way, he goes, I have been commanded to kill the people that would include Muslims as well, so it couldn't be accepted like this. And that's what he was saying. And he said that, so therefore it's a general, but it's urida bihi khas, or al-khusus, which is like, you know, and what does that mean?
So, especially with an-nas, like you can have, but generally speaking anyways, if you have general terms, you can use a general term in Arabic, but intend by it something specific.
Give me an example.
That's indicated by it. So even with the word an-nas, for example, they say in Surah Nisa, "Am yahsuduna an-nasa ala ma atahum Allah min fadli." Some of them say that refers to the Prophet.
There's another ayah which I'm thinking about.
The one in Imran with an-nas.
Yeah.
In Imran.
Go on.
Surah Al-Ahzab. I can see it on the page. What's there's an ayah in Surah
Al-Ahzab. There's an ayah here. وَإِذَا قِيلَ لَهُمْ آمَنُوا كَمَا آمَنَ النَّاسُ.
Not this one.
Could you use that?
No. When that the people have come against you.
This is the one, yeah.
Yeah, so what is there?
Yeah, الَّذِينَ قَالَ لَهُمُ النَّاسُ إِنَّ النَّاسَ قَدْ جَمَعُوا لَكُمْ. Now.
Okay, so here, the Nas, what are you saying to?
That, if I remember correctly, I think it was referring to, was it two people from,
Ahzab.
الَّذِينَ قَالَ لَهُمُ النَّاسُ إِنَّ النَّاسَ قَدْ جَمَعُوا لَكُمْ فَخْشَوْهُمْ.
So it's the Confederates that are coming.
It's not one. It's not all the people.
It's just a group of people.
Yeah. So this is an example of
a specific group of people.
Yeah. So it's an example of general wording intended for specific meaning. But I put that out there because it was a difficult one. I wanted to see how you guys were going to deal with it. Yeah.
But
sorry.
Even if that's the case, that it's not from Muslims. The Prophet didn't kill every non-Muslim out
good
there.
Good point. Excellent.
So
yeah, good point.
He didn't practice his own.
Yeah, brilliant. That's a good piece of evidence. So it couldn't mean that. Could it? What if I say now, Furqan, you know, this is a very common interrogation. Chapter 929. قَاتِلُوا الَّذِينَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِاللَّهِ وَلَا بِالْيَوْمِ الْآخِرِ. You know, that fight the ones who do not believe in Allah and the last day from the people who have been given the kitab, from the people who have been given the people of the book. You know, until they give the jizya in a subordinate fashion and they are subservient, or it's clear here, isn't it, that they're saying you have to keep fighting the Christians and Jews until they give jizya. So it's compelling them to give jizya. This shows you clearly that it's about forcing people to become Muslim. What would you say to something like that?
Isn't a jizya for Christians, Jews living in a Muslim land.
Yes.
So, I'm guessing if that's compulsory part of the Muslim country. So, if you want to live in this country, you need to pay this tax or jizya.
Okay.
And someone refuses to do so. I guess there is consequences for that.
Yes, but why do you have to fight them to get them to pay that?
So what do? Then? Or do you expel them then?
Yeah, I think you're onto something. Well, you can refine this because you're a bit too non-apologetic here. I think you to give them some level of just. Okay, I think that
I'm asking you, like, if they if they don't pay, then I mean, there needs to be a way.
Yeah, no, but it's saying you have to fight them first, then get them to pay after. So what's going on here? Hatta, it says until they give the jizya. So clearly they're not given the jizya now. So they have to fight them until they do it.
So I'm guessing that context is when the Muslims were still fighting with the non-believers or Christians.
Are you guessing? I'm meant to be the one asking you. So who's do you know this or do you not know this?
You're asking a lay person. So
okay. No, but you're on the right tracks. I mean, especially with this thing of jizya being like a compulsory tax. Jizya is not. I actually don't see the controversy in jizya at all. I fail to see the controversy in it. They call it a sec. I remember in university when the one person was saying you have a discriminatory tax called the jizya. I said, what is discriminatory about it exactly? What's the problem with it? What's your issue with the jizya? So it's, why is it that the Muslims get to pay zakat and zakat is more? Actually, you pay more. In some cases, Muslims have to pay much more than the. I was reading Ibn Hajar, this is half a dinar or ruba dinar or something. The amount of money is not. If you have zakat al mal and zakat this one and the zara and this and the plantations, and you might be paying a lot more zakat than anyone would be paying jizya. So it's not even about more. It's not more money necessarily. That's not what it's about. So what is the issue here? So that's I like that line of argumentation. It's just a name difference. Zakah is like has purification connotations.
They're also exempted from a lot of things. They don't have to fight, do they?
No,
there's
no.
There's a war. The people who pay jizya, they don't have to fight.
Is that right? Yeah, they don't have to fight. Yeah, you see, it's subhanAllah. You know, they just don't betray the Muslim community and stuff like that. But as we've said, it's not really that problematic. I like that part of it. It's like hearing this, making it. But this, how would you assess the first part, 929, Mahdi?
As in, we're not going out to enforce this on people. This is just like if we have a battle between each other, right?
Who's having a battle with who?
Like if they're coming and they're attacking us and we're defending ourselves. So if there's a war, if it's a time of war, it's not like we're going out in this context, right?
Okay, so how do we know this is not talking about civilians?
Qatilu.
How? Okay, go tell me more about that.
So it's just like, how do you express it? It's just with another person.
So it's reciprocal?
Yeah, reciprocal. That's it, yeah.
And how do we know it's reciprocal?
Because it's with the alif on the.
Beautiful.
The
qaf. So, yeah, so fa'ala. It's like. Al-musharak, I say. It's like for both of them are doing the same thing. So this is fight, not kill. It's not. It's not kill them.
It's fight. Yeah.
Yeah. So it must be fight. You cannot fight people that are not fighting you back. So it must be combatants. So even in the term qatilu, there is an implied imputation, which is that actually this is already reciprocal battle going on.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, these are some of the things. I'm going to bring two more things just to come back to Furqan. But be sure with this one that you don't say anything ridiculous, because this is a very controversial topic. What if I say, well, if your Prophet ﷺ was so peaceful and so merciful, then what about the Jewish tribes of Banu Qurayza? That he oversaw the slaughter of 600 Jewish people in the tribe, and he in fact encouraged or legitimized it or mandated it. If this was a man of mercy, then how could he do such a thing?
So first of all, I would say there was a treaty between the two.
Yeah. Who's to two?
Between the Muslims and the Jews.
Okay, the Jewish tribes, yeah.
The Jewish tribes, yeah, to protect the Muslims in case of outsiders.
Yeah.
In this case, Meccans attacking.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews not only break the treaty, but they align with the Meccans.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to the punishment, it was not the Prophet deciding the punishment. It was actually someone neutral that decided that.
Does anyone remember who it was?
Sa'd ibn Mu'adh.
Yeah, Sa'd ibn Mu'adh, yeah.
Decided that that was supposed to be the fair punishment.
Excellent. So, and who was being punished?
Only the men and the Jews.
So those who are capable of what?
Fighting, yeah.
Beautiful, excellent, excellent answer. Well done. That was really good. So these are the, what I'm giving you here is the interrogations you're most likely to face. After you've answered them, remember the framework is the APECA framework. Who remembers the APECA framework? Yeah, A stands for assumption, P stands for point, E stands for example, C stands for counterattack or counterexample, and an A is an analysis. So always have that as a blueprint to any shubuhat that you're given. The APECA framework, APECA. You start with the assumption, then the point, then the example, then the counterexample, and then the analysis. Because if you don't offer a counter, you're taking a punch without giving one back. So you, whenever you have to defend yourself, then you have to attack. And with that, guys, we will conclude. Hopefully, this is more entrenched into your minds. This is something we've covered before, but repetition of key issues is actually an important part of any spiral curriculum. It's an important part of any kind of learning. And so next week we're going to be talking about the age of Aisha. And we've got some more information which we haven't covered in previous sessions, which we're going to talk about. The age of Aisha and the marriage and the union of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which is one of the key shubuhat. And so one which we use, it's a classic shubha, basically. It's one of the classic shubuhat. So everyone here needs to be completely like strong with that one. And it will be more like this session, where we're going to be doing a lot more interactive stuff. And hopefully you guys have enjoyed that as much as I have here. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.